Welcome to the SOHO Forum, a monthly debate series that features topics of special interest to libertarians and aims to enhance social and professional ties within New York City's libertarian community. We're partnered with Reason Magazine in presenting these debates, and you can catch audio of all our events on the Reason podcast, which you'll find in the iTunes store. Thanks also to the Smith Family Foundation for making this series possible. I'm Gene Epstein, economics and books editor at Barron's Financial Weekly and the SOHO Forum director and moderator. For more information and to buy tickets to our future debates, go to our website at thesohoforum.org. This is an Oxford-style debate in which the audience initially votes for, against, or undecided on the resolution, and then again after the debate is over. Whoever moves the vote in his favor is declared the winner. Tonight's resolution is as follows. The U.S. government should offer a Medicare-like plan that would be available to all Americans buying health insurance. Kate DeCherbo, we are now closing the voting. Kate? Okay. She's got all the votes initially. Defending the resolution, we have Paul Starr of Princeton University, author of The Social Transformation of American Medicine. Paul, please come to the stage. Arguing for the negative, we have David Goldhill, author of Catastrophic Care. David, please come to the stage. Now, Paul Starr, you have 12 minutes to defend the resolution. The U.S. government should offer a Medicare-like plan that would be available to all Americans buying health insurance. Take it away, Paul.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak in favor of the idea of providing Medicare, a Medicare-like plan, as an option for people buying health insurance. Now, first, let me make three points about Medicare. One, among Americans with all types of insurance, those on Medicare are the most satisfied with their coverage. Medicare is, in the United States, the most popular form of coverage. Second, Medicare has done a far better job of controlling healthcare costs than has the non-Medicare private insurance market. And third, while in general, Americans are not as healthy as citizens of the other wealthy democracies, Americans 65 years of age and over do better on health indicators than others their age in peer countries. So Medicare is more popular, it has slower growth in costs, and the people who depend on it are on average healthier than their counterparts in many peer countries. All of these, I believe, good reasons why we ought to make Medicare and Medicare-like plan available to other Americans as an option. Now, I am not suggesting Medicare is perfect as it is. There are ways to improve it to get a better value for money. And some important tests of alternatives are currently underway within Medicare. I'm also not suggesting Medicare would need no adjustments for people under age 65, and I'm also not saying that the development of a Medicare option could be done overnight. It ought to be done in stages, assessing the results as we go along. What I'd like to do this evening in my 12 minutes is outline a couple of concrete steps we could take in that direction and the reasons they make sense. But first, I want to make several clarifications. First, we're not debating single payer this evening. A Medicare-like option, otherwise known as a public option, is not the same as single payer. As soon as you say option, as soon as you refer to making a plan available, as this resolution does, you're not talking about reducing all healthcare finance to a single payer. Second, let's understand how Medicare works. Medicare gives seniors a choice between the traditional public Medicare plan and private, so-called Medicare Advantage plans. So if we could strip away ideological blinders, we could see that Medicare itself is a marketplace. It has multiple plans, varying in structure and to a lesser extent in benefits. Medicare, however, is different from the marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act for people under age 65 who purchase insurance individually. Medicare is different because it has a public option, a public plan chosen by about two-thirds of seniors, a plan that actually gives them a much wider choice of doctors and hospitals than most Americans have these days. And the Medicare program as a whole does a good job controlling costs because the public plan sets prices for providers that the private plans can shadow price, that is, they tend to follow Medicare's lead. So the advantage of Medicare's price discipline spill over into the private Medicare market. Third, we're not even talking this evening, at least as I understand it, about Medicare for All. The debate tonight is about making a Medicare-like plan available to other Americans who buy insurance. And I'm going to interpret the resolution as being, in the first instance, specifically about Americans who need to pay for health insurance, who need to obtain health insurance on their own. That is, who don't have an employer-provided plan or coverage through the military or the veterans healthcare system or any other system. And the problems with our health insurance system have long been most acute for people who buy insurance individually or through small businesses and who don't qualify for Medicaid, the VA, or any other program. They're the people who the health insurance marketplaces and affordability subsidies and the ACA were designed to help. But there continue to be problems in those markets, problems aggravated by the Trump administration's war of attrition against Obamacare, problems that will be aggravated even more if Congress repeals the ACA and puts us back in the world where people with pre-existing conditions can't get coverage. Now, one of the core problems, perhaps the most important problem in the individual insurance market, is the lack of competition in many parts of the country. In many of those areas, these are mostly in rural areas and in the South, there is only one insurer, and in a few cases there have temporarily been no insurers. Now, the Trump administration has aggravated that problem by creating uncertainty in the insurance market, uncertainty because of its uncertainty about enforcing the law or about fulfilling certain obligations under the law to insurance companies that are legally obligated to provide certain kinds of subsidies. And as a result of that, the Congressional Budget Office has projected an increase of 2 million people in the number of uninsured for this coming year after the ACA cut the proportion of uninsured in the United States from 16% in 2010 to 8.8% in 2016. Now, from the beginning, the ACA should have had a fallback provision for a public option to guarantee adequate competition in those areas where the market failed to respond. And that kind of provision is more necessary now, clearly necessary now. So here's the first concrete proposal that I've made together with Jacob Hacker, who was supposed to be here this evening. This can be found at the website of the journal Health Affairs. Wherever there are two or fewer options, that is in these specific marketplaces for individuals, Congress would introduce Medicare into those marketplaces. Now, in other words, not only would the public Medicare would public Medicare offer a plan? We'd also require insurers who already compete in a region's Medicare Advantage market also to offer a plan in the ACA marketplace. So it's basically linking the Medicare marketplace to the ACA marketplace. And it boosts competition in a way particularly advantageous to enrollees. Unlike most of the, is that 5 minutes? Oh, that's all right. Unlike most of the narrow network private plans in the ACA marketplaces, Medicare offers a wide choice of providers because nearly all hospitals and doctors take Medicare. And that broad choice is one of the reasons for the high level of satisfaction with Medicare. Building on Medicare and Medicare Advantage will give people in the individual and small group market more choice and help create competition where it's faltered. Now, the second idea that I've offered for expanding access to Medicare is what I've called midlife Medicare. And it would enable people ages 50 to 64 who have not been offered an employer plan and they're not eligible for any other coverage, to buy into Medicare. And as in senior Medicare, the beneficiaries of midlife Medicare would need to pay premiums, although Congress would subsidize midlife Medicare to the same extent it subsidizes employer-provided coverage, compensating also for the effects of adverse selection. Adverse selection is the tendency only for relatively sick people to enroll when they are not obligated to, just as the Republican bill in the House would have created a patient stabilization fund to cover high-risk individuals. Now, I make these proposals in the spirit of incremental change. As I see it, introducing Medicare into the ACA marketplaces would resolve many of the immediate problems that you read about in the press. Midlife Medicare would pull out of those marketplaces a relatively costly older adult population, reducing premiums for the under 50 population. Now, if Republicans repeal the ACA, as seems a distinct possibility again this week, the case for midlife Medicare would be even stronger because it's that older adult group, 50 to 64, that will be hit the hardest by the loss of the subsidies and the increase in private insurance premiums that would follow. If we were to pass midlife Medicare, the question of making a Medicare-like plan available to younger people, that is, people under age 50, that is, people without employer coverage, would also arise. And I could imagine, again, some incremental extension of this idea of making Medicare available to younger ages. But again, this is not the same as single payer. This really involves trying to fill in one of the problems in the existing health insurance market. So these ideas would not require turning healthcare in America upside down, but they would advance the cause of providing all Americans with good healthcare at costs that are subject to stronger discipline than we have historically had. And I see I have 2 minutes left, but I will cede those 2 minutes to David and perhaps reclaim them in the second round.
This is not an exchange of minutes system. David, you guessed just 12 minutes, and the 2 minutes is gone. David, take it away for the negative. No, I'm sorry. 12 minutes for the negative from David Goldhill.
Well, thank you, Gene, and thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. And Paul, it's a pleasure to share the stage with you, and truly an honor. The Social Transformation of American Medicine is the first book I ever read about healthcare, and frankly, the first book anyone should read about healthcare. It's extraordinary. I want to start with a story, which I think is against the rules. 4 years ago, one of my best friend's father was told that his aortic valve was going to fail at some point. He needed a valve replacement, and the sooner the better. He consulted the cardiac surgeons at 5 big New York hospitals and was stunned by how aggressively they pursued him. He was a Medicare patient. He was 83 years old. Part of the Medicare argument is that Medicare pays prices so low that hospitals lose money on patients. He didn't experience that. In fact, they pursued him so aggressively that he was interested in a less invasive procedure that was part of a double-blind trial that was being conducted at New York hospitals. And one of them said, "We have a way of getting you in the procedure regardless." He had the valve replacement. Roughly 90,000 Medicare patients a year have a valve replacement. And according to Medicare, it was a perfectly successful operation. He was alive 30 days later. And in fact, it was miraculous. He had his valve replaced, was out of the hospital in 4 or 5 days, was walking around. 4 months later, he was dead. And the reason he was dead is because at some point, he banged something for some part of his body on something. And he bled to death because everybody who gets a valve operation has to take anticoagulants. Now, the reason I'm telling this story is because it's unbelievably common. The last time somebody looked, and it's about 5 years ago, of the 2 million Medicare beneficiaries who die in a given year, roughly 700,000 had surgery that year. out of every five over 90 who die in a given year, one has surgery. And there's almost no surgery recommended for somebody over 90 because the risk reward is terrible. It's very convenient for those who care about politics to talk about access to healthcare, money. How do we pay for people to get healthcare? As if it's some black box, some commodity. Well, I'm going to violate two of the rules of talking about healthcare tonight. One is I'm not going to pretend it's this black box that we just buy. I'm going to pretend something that we all know is true, which is how we pay for it determines what we get. And the second thing I'm going to do is I'm going to leave, not often, the island of healthcare, in which we tell ourselves that all that matters is healthcare. There was a hilarious piece in the New York Times talking to five healthcare experts about which country had the best healthcare system. And they all dissed my favorite Singapore because not transparent enough, not this, not that. Singapore spends 4% of GDP on healthcare. Not a single one of these economists said, can you imagine all the social good you can do if you save 14% of GDP? Every conversation about healthcare is, how do we make sure everybody has all the healthcare they need? And in doing so, we have starved our population, and particularly our most needy, of the other things they need, many of which are more important. Medicare drives a certain type of care. It may be popular, but here's what it really is. It's excessive, it's treatment biased, it's tons and tons of operations, and it's no general practitioners. There are 7,000 geriatricians left in the country, and eventually there will be zero. So as a result, if you are over 75, there's a 50% chance you're on five drugs. There's a 50% chance if you are, that at least two of those drugs are contraindicated. You shouldn't be taking both. This is a totally unregulated, out-of-control system whose biggest beneficiary is the healthcare industry. And the people who should be most aware of that are least aware of it, because they're so busy arguing for more healthcare, more access, and all the rest, that they don't realize the system we've built. Now, my interest in healthcare began with my father's death from a medical accident. So according to Johns Hopkins, medical accidents are now the third leading cause of death in the United States. 250,000 a year. Most of them are in hospitals. Almost all of them are among Medicare beneficiaries. Now, it's never listed as a cause of death. Almost no states say medical error. So you're not aware of it. But it's 250,000 people a year. Which means in the 20 years since Bill Clinton proposed healthcare reform, we've probably lost 2.5 million Americans. I'm sorry, 4.5 million Americans to errors committed while Medicare was their payer. And we could say, hey, it's all a matter of money, but I just can't believe that. Now, one of the key things that we need to understand about Medicare is its illusions. And the biggest illusion is that it's cheap. How something that has gone from $1 billion in spending to $675 billion in spending in 2.5 generations is called cheap, I have no idea. But in understanding how a public option will work and the incentives it will give to our healthcare system, it's important to understand what Medicare calls cheap. First of all, the biggest thing is it costs almost nothing to administer. Almost everybody who writes in favor of a public option or Medicare for All says, private health insurers spend 15% of benefits on just administration. Medicare spends 2%. That's got to be cheap. Something sound wrong with that? Well, here's a hint. Private insurers do Medicare's administration for it as subcontractors. Have you ever heard of somebody who will pay somebody, a housekeeper, who will take less for cleaning other people's houses than he'll pay for having someone clean their own house? That's what you're inclined to believe, that some health insurers are doing administration for Medicare less than they do it with their own money. What's really going on? Well, private insurers say no to things. They judge appropriateness. They judge safety. They judge quality. Medicare's mandate is to say yes to everything. And of course, the great irony is, so it costs $13.5 billion to administer Medicare's $675 billion. But Medicare says it has roughly $70 billion of fraud every year. Now, here's the great thing about government accounting. That $70 billion of fraud, they don't count as an expense. They count it as benefits paid. So, you know, the $70 billion of fraud, by the way, completely eliminates their administrative advantage in cost, what they say is cheaper. But we got to remember, Medicare is a political program. Its constituency is politicians or policy analysts, not business people. If you've run a business, you understand what's going on. Medicare is a bank without security guards. It's the nonprofit model. Look how much money we pay out and how little it costs us to do it. Underlying that, and by the way, a bank could run without security guards, but unlike Medicare, it couldn't tell its board of directors, you know, the money stolen counts as revenue. The second element of Medicare's supposed cheapness, though, is the most important one, which is Medicare pays hospitals and doctors less than private insurance. Well, if you've been in business, you recognize the make-it-up-in-volume fallacy problem there. Again, who's the constituency? Politicians, policy analysts, academics. Who cares what price you pay a hospital if you let the hospital bundle as many different diagnoses as possible? When we look at how Medicare has grown in cost and where that cost goes, to argue it's cheap is absurd. Using MedPAC's own words, I love this. Rapid volume growth may be a sign that some services in the fee schedule for physicians and other health professionals are mispriced. In other words, we pay them so little they do more of them than they should. And that is the story of Medicare. Now, why is it like this? Well, the reason it's like this is because Medicare was based on a very dishonest statement to us and to providers. To us, Medicare says something that no other country on earth has ever said. We're an entitlement. We will pay for all the health care you need. How did the industry respond to that? By endlessly increasing the definition of need. It's so obvious that you'd have to be, you'd never have to work in a business to do that. Medicare is dominated by special interests. There are 17 medical trade associations whose CEOs earn between $1 and $5 million a year. It's not to convince Medicare to be more efficient. The health industry spends $500 million a year on lobbying. Our hospitals operate at 65% capacity, 20% less than the rest of the world. They stay in business because Medicare keeps them afloat. We have so few geriatricians because the specialists run the price-setting mechanism. So really understanding how Medicare works makes you rethink what's a public option. What is a public option? It's an option. That sounds like, you know, what could be bad about an option? Except it's nonsense. The people who originally proposed a public option admitted years ago that what they were really trying to do was get to single payer. We see how difficult it is for insurers to price the type of customers that Professor Starr was talking about. Try to imagine the government saying, you can take this option, here's the price. How do we set that price? No idea. Now, what Medicare's supporters and public option supporters say is, oh, we'll set it in competition with insurers. But remember what Medicare does, right? It allows large amounts of fraud, it never says no. No insurer can compete with that. Public option advocates like to say the nice thing about Medicare as a competitor is it doesn't need to make a profit. That's not what makes Medicare a competitor. It's that it doesn't care about losses. This year, general revenues, your tax money, will subsidize Medicare to the tune of $320 billion. The price of a public option will be whatever Medicare wants it to be. And when politicians want single payer, it'll be so low that a private insurer can't compete. And if it's too high, by the way, we'll just have a high-risk pool that'll be extraordinary expense. What Medicare hasn't proven, and I mean real Medicare, not the pretend, oh, I wish it were better, we could improve it, it's 51 years old. As a man in my 50s, we don't improve. It is what it is. And what it is the core feature driving the undisciplined supply, pricing, and utilization of care that has so undermined the social welfare of the average American citizen. Thanks.
Paul Starr, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Take it away, Paul.
So we actually have a Medicare program that involves private insurers, although you might never know it from the description that David gave. We have a working marketplace in Medicare. He presented it as if the idea of a public option was just a kind of insidious way of introducing a single nationalized insurance plan. But actually, private insurers have done very well in Medicare. I mentioned that about one-third of Medicare beneficiaries choose a private plan. Actually, among new beneficiaries, it's about one-half. So it is a working model. The fact that we have a public Medicare plan doesn't make it impossible for private insurers to compete. They do compete. And that same kind of model can be applied to the population under age 65. Now, I want to come to a number of the points that David made. I didn't write them down. I mean, I got them in exact order. Yes, Medicare does pay less than private insurers. Now, the question you might want to ask yourself is, why do private, this is the private insurers outside of Medicare, not within Medicare, private insurers, as I said, shadow price Medicare, but in the employer market, private insurers pay a great deal more than Medicare. In the individual market, they pay more than Medicare. Why is that? And that's partly because of the monopolies that have developed, especially at the local level, throughout the healthcare system. This is a point that I make in there's a new edition of The Social Transformation of American Medicine. It's a book that came out in 1982. There's one that just came out in June, a new updated edition. And one of the big themes of the additional material that I've added has to do with the growing consolidation control in local healthcare markets, the rise of large hospital systems, often with what are called must-have institutions, must-have from the point of view of insurers and employers, and those powerful healthcare systems have been able to drive up the payment rates to much higher levels than Medicare pays. The industry tells a story that it's cost shifting because it doesn't get as much as Medicare. It has to get more from private insurers. But if that were the case, then those hospitals that had more Medicare beneficiaries would have especially high rates. It's actually not true. Where Medicare is important, private insurers also pay less. The evidence actually is contrary to what David suggested, that Medicare has helped instill cost discipline, and that expanding Medicare, making it available to other people, would help create a greater discipline in costs in the American healthcare system. Is the way David described the history, it was only Medicare that was driving the economic evolution of the American healthcare system. That's just not so. The employer-based private insurance system has been a very powerful influence on the way our system has evolved, and it has been especially weak in controlling costs. Insurers have been able to pass those costs on to employers. Employers have been able to pass those costs on to workers, and employees and their families don't know that money is deducted from paychecks before they ever see them. They have very little way of acting effectively in the marketplace. I believe that extending a public option would have an important role as a countervailing force to this concentrated power that has developed in the healthcare industry.
Thank you, Paul. 5 minutes for you, David, for your rebuttal.
Thank you. I didn't forget that Medicare Advantage exists. Describing it as a marketplace is pretty remarkable. Medicare sets the rates, it reimburses, describes the policies fairly in depth. And in fact, I think Medicare Advantage is just a wonderful example of how extraordinarily corrupting the incentives of Medicare is. The theory was, let's create an option for seniors within Medicare. So Medicare Advantage pays slightly more than their fee-for-service number. It depends. It's changed from year to year. And quickly, what insurers discovered is the key was to define your benefits so that you got the healthier Medicare patients and made more money. That doesn't sound like much of a marketplace to me. The argument stays, right? I just cannot accept that the primary customer of our hospital sector that allows a 65% capacity industry to operate at a 7 or 8% market is great for controlling costs. I get it. The prices look low. But any of us who've actually been in business know that the price is low is not the same as genuine industrial discipline. Look at the big numbers. And in fact, let's look at the big numbers. You know, there's probably no metaphor used more than the boiling frogs metaphor. And Professor Starr is right. Seniors love Medicare because the alternative is too frightening. But let's pretend somehow that a 65-year-old when Medicare was passed was alive today. Here's what that senior would have found. That the share of health care they pay out of pocket had gone from 10% of their income to 18% of their income. That in an average year, they spend $3,500 of their own money on health care. That Medicare premiums and cost sharing take 25% of their Social Security benefit. Now, just like every other healthcare program we've had, when Medicare was passed, it was going to solve all these problems. It was going to take care of cost control, give you access, and all the rest. The problem of health costs for seniors now is meaningfully greater than it was in 1965. They don't know it because they weren't alive in 1960, or they weren't seniors in 1965. And this is how the entire healthcare system has developed. This is how we got to 18% of GDP. All incremental, helpful ideas like the public option, all things that are really going to make it cheaper and really make it universal. I believe in universal access to care. But the difficulty with the things like Medicare is because they're political programs that disguise their true working, they wind up shifting ever more of our dollars from everything else to healthcare. And we are poorer for it. Healthcare is the 10th most important factor in health, measured by almost anything. You name it. Income, education, safety of your community, marital status, having a job. All of these things have a lot more to do with your health. And as the United States has uniquely gone to 18% of GDP on healthcare, we have less for that. David Brooks referred to the US government as an emerging healthcare state. We can afford nothing else. If you believe that this latest great idea to solve the problem, the 7th or 8th, will have any different result than the others, then I appreciate your optimism. I wish I shared it, because I believe in universal coverage. Over time, like in anything else that matters, the only way we will make sure everybody has affordable health care is to do something meaningful about prices. There's no financial engineering that turns expensive health care into affordable health care. It just moves the money around. And the only way we're going to have health care that has the impact on our lives close to the amount of money we're spending is for it to be good. And while we focus in the political arena all the time on people who don't have access and all the rest, the amazing thing is the fatality rate because of excess, undisciplined care in the United States far exceeds the fatality rate for people who don't get care. It's not part of the discussion. It's not as much fun. It's much more fun to talk about access and be, you know, this wonderful giving person guaranteeing care to everybody. But what has it wrought? What do we really have? And as we think about healthcare down the road, what is it that we want our healthcare system to look like?
Thank you, David. Yeah. All right, in this part of the debate, each side gets to ask each other two questions. Paul, would you be willing to go first and ask David a question?
So, David, I was stunned at the end when you said you were in favor of universal coverage. I'm not quite sure how you plan to get there. That might be the first question, but let me also ask you this. You seem to be suggesting that because of the stark character of your criticism, seniors should just go cold turkey on Medicare.
I understand.
Well, you say Medicare is killing people, basically. You say the healthcare system is killing people, that people who don't get treated are better off than people who get treated. That, well, actually, I think, actually, if we could roll back the tape.
I said there were fewer.
There were fewer people who, okay. Well, it sounded to me very similar to a doctrine in the 19th century known as therapeutic nihilism. And actually, if you go back to the 1830s, 1840s, therapeutic nihilism was justified because the medicine in that day probably did kill more people. But you've got a kind of updated therapeutic nihilism. You've got a view that the healthcare system is so terrible, putting money into it is so destructive, that Americans would be better off if they just didn't have it. We should go back to 4% of GDP instead of what we're spending now. That would mean closing down a lot of hospitals and letting go a lot of doctors and nurses. Is that what you mean?
Okay, that's the question. David, please respond to the question.
Yeah, so no, I'm not calling for abolishing healthcare. What I'm calling for, although we should abolish the term, but that's a different subject. Because there's talking about 10 or 15,000 different services consumed in different ways in different parts of our life as if it's one thing has probably cost this country more value than almost any other political error we make. But let me deal with what I think you misunderstood about what I was saying. So my focus is on the incentives to practice healthcare in the system we've built. History major, I respect the history, but the reality is there isn't a healthcare industry until well into the 20th century in the sense of providing any value and worth arguing over. The issue is the incentives and how we buy healthcare, how does an industry respond? And my argument is the unique American politics and the unique American political structure has so warped the incentives in our public programs that the damage caused by excess care, undisciplined care, lack of the normal responsiveness to consumer need. Look, 75% of care dollars in this country are spent on chronic conditions. And yet we have an industry that packages almost everything on a fee-for-service basis, and all the experiments that Medicare has done to do something different have wound up creating those very monopolies you talked about. I am focused on how care is actually delivered for our 18% of GDP. So I am in favor of universal coverage. I've argued, written a book, that if we can understand that what we're trying to insure against is catastrophe, and not warp an entire industry by trying to include everything in this insurance rubric, we will have something that closer serves our social needs and is better balanced in society with everything else. And let me just make one last point. One of the key things I talk about when I'm talking about the island is the fact that there can be no trade-off between what we spend on healthcare and any of our other goals as a society or as individuals. Putting everything into an insurance system, creating Medicare as an entitlement and Medicaid as kind of a part entitlement, is absolutely unique in the world. No one else has done that, where there's no leakage. Once it's healthcare, it's gonna get spent on healthcare. It's not, as an employer, it's not surprising to me that the cost of healthcare goes up every year, even though people get healthier, because that's not what drives it. What drives it is these industrial factors. And so when I hear yet another idea for doing more of the same, I can't help but notice that Medicare didn't solve seniors' financing problem in healthcare, neither did Medicaid. The Affordable Care Act has extended coverage, but it's almost useless because of the deductibles. And I also noticed that we've maintained different healthcare systems for seniors, for poor people, for veterans, and all the rest. And I don't think that's just about money.
That's your answer, okay. David, a question for Paul.
So when I started getting interested in care as an employer, I looked at what a young person is going to contribute into our healthcare system over her lifetime. And so I took literally somebody starting out for us, and I looked at all of the insurance premiums that would be paid in her name over her lifetime, her Medicare premiums, the Medicare taxes, because as you know, we now subsidize Medicare enormously through general tax revenues, the amount she'd spend on Medicaid, everything for the safety net and for healthcare. And I made a couple of important assumptions. One is that, you know, she lived through life what used to roughly be the average, got married, had kids. I assume she never got sick, meaningfully sick. And I assume she never got rich, but she was solidly middle class her whole life. So using a 0% growth rate, the number was $1.2 million. That's what we're asking a 23-year-old today to have put out of her income into our healthcare system to maintain this safety net and to maintain this extraordinarily centralized care. How do you justify that to her?
Well, you've taken that number. That number is kind of meaningless since you're projecting somebody's. But you know, we do spend a lot on healthcare in the United States. It's 18% of the economy. It's 18% of national income and 18% of gross domestic product. Of course, those numbers are all going to look big. What surprises me about your approach is that if you wanted to spend a lot less on healthcare, you'd look at the countries that spend a lot less on healthcare. The other rich countries, I mean, not the poor ones. The other rich countries, meaning Britain, France, Sweden, mostly European countries. And they have a lot more governmental control of healthcare than we do. They regulate, they control prices, they control employment in the healthcare sector. So someone who started out with your view that we're just spending so much more of our economy than we should be on healthcare, it seems to me on the basis of the comparative evidence, would be drawn to exactly the opposite conclusion, that we need a lot more government control, not less, because really you may have your Singapore case, but otherwise you don't have a lot of evidence to support your view, which again, it's really kind of hard for me to decipher what your view ultimately is, that if government pulled out, that the market would operate in such a way that we would be back at a much lower level of expenditure.
Well, no one, can we just, okay, can, right, I, right, can right, we treat right. that as our questions to each other that we're, because right, yeah. So Singapore may be the most government-controlled healthcare system on Earth. But it uses free market principles to exercise that control. This is not for me an ideology of whether it's government or not government. That's irrelevant. And the examples of other countries are irrelevant because none of them have our political system. So nobody has a Medicare program, the equivalent of a Medicare program that is run for insiders. The degree by which special interests set prices, determine service, prevent regulation in Medicare is absolutely unique on Earth. And I remember once in a debate like this, someone saying, we should have Sweden's system. We don't have Sweden's system of government. What we have is a system of government in which you're always allowed to lobby everything. And to look at Medicare, and it's why I brought it up, and not understand the extent to which, I would say this to you, you're someone who's been so conscious of special interests over your career. Who do you think runs Medicare? This fantasy that Medicare makes no decisions on appropriateness. When Medicare decided that men over 75 shouldn't have PSA tests, didn't stop paying for them. Half of them still do. When Medicare decided people shouldn't have spinal fusions, didn't stop paying for it. Industry wouldn't let it. Let's talk about America, because America's problem is unique.
Okay, you blew your second question. Paul, you have a second question.
Okay. Yeah. If America's political system is so utterly rotten with special interests, how do you propose, working with the institutions that we have, how do you propose to change it? I mean, it really sounds
so
hopeless.
Don't be pessimistic. No, I hate to see that. I'm probably the only real optimist in the room because, almost all of our ideas about healthcare are 70, 80 years old. The NHS is 70 years old. This is an absolute dinosaur. Healthcare is changing radically. When the national health system started and we decided insurance should run everything in healthcare, it was a different thing. Healthcare was rare and major and urgent, and the integration into our lives from birth to death didn't exist. So when the big national healthcare systems were created, almost all care was therapy. It wasn't chronic condition, which is the bulk of what we do now. It's already changed in two generations with a system that hasn't changed with it. Going forward, we look at a world of personalized cures, something the system hasn't done since we had infectious diseases. What we need to understand is healthcare is a dynamic industry. And the idea that these 70-year-old systems are what should guide us strikes me as absurd. Healthcare is an essential like food. And we used to insist that food be divvied out by the high priests. It was just too important to be left to the markets. The further you are from that, the more food your people have. We need to reintegrate healthcare, which means we want a safety net for urgent things in healthcare. Let's have one. Let's have an insurance system for catastrophes. But if each one of my employees is going to put $1 million into healthcare over her lifetime without her getting rich, her single biggest expense, if that's what we have today before this newest plan, today imposed on our young people, then we need to stop. And we need to think about, here's what we want a safety net for. Here's where we want to bring in some market forces, competition. Here's where we want consumers to be empowered. You don't need a single idea to solve an industry with tens of thousands of goods and services. It's okay to have a hybrid. And instead, what we've done is we look for a magic bullet. And in anything complex, a magic bullet is a foolish exercise. And we are not the only country suffering under very rapidly increasing healthcare costs. All of those other systems are.
Thank you, David. Okay, questions from the audience now. Line up, please, and I don't quite see you, but is there somebody up at the mic who is going to ask the first question? The microphone is back there. Are there people lining up? And please phrase your question as a question and avoid speechifying. First questioner at the mic, please ask your question.
When Obamacare was launched, I recall that the government funded co-ops, which were public insurance plans, a public option sort of, to compete with the private insurance companies. And my understanding is most of them have imploded and failed. I unfortunately was in one of them, First Republic here in New York State, which failed. So since we've already done a program with the government funding insurance companies to compete with private insurance companies, why would this new idea work?
Yeah, well, that provision for co-ops was actually a substitute for a public option. It wasn't a public option. It was a public option that would have been operated by Medicare. Would not have had the problems that those little undercapitalized co-ops had. So one of the difficulties that many of them had is that they had too little capital to sustain themselves in the marketplace. Whenever you have a new market, this was true actually in the Medicare market back when it was beginning, when Medicare had when private Medicare plans were beginning. It's very difficult to estimate risks. There's a lot of turbulence in markets before they settle down. And many of those co-ops, as I said, they had relatively little capital. They made mistakes estimating their costs, and they got into trouble. And also, the Republican Congress withdrew a lot of the funding for them. So this is not a question of simple natural mortality. There was an active effort to kill them, to shut them down by the Republican Congress that helped snuff out the survivors. So that's a poor example of a public option. It has nothing to do with the Medicare proposal that we were talking about this evening.
Well, I think, you know, the questioner makes an excellent point, missing just one thing. I think you're wrong that most of them went out of business. I think they all went out of business. I don't think there's a single one that survived.
No, there are some.
Are there still a couple left?
Yeah,
it's essentially all of them. And it was the point I made in the first debate, the first part of this debate, is that a public option is fantasy, right? There's no way to price this. This is all about the government increasing its role in insurance. And by the way, That's a reasonable argument to have. But the idea that the government is going to suddenly act like a competitive insurance company, or that in telling Medicare Advantage providers that it is somehow running a marketplace, is absurd. These co-ops were intended to demonstrate in a real marketplace how a public option would work. And here's how it works. The government is going to have to be willing to absorb the kind of losses these cooperatives were unable to absorb. I think
just not the history of what happened.
Okay. Well, they're actually all thriving. I'm wrong.
The idea came from people who were opposed to the public.
Yes, but we are nevertheless have grown since Medicare started from 5.5% of GDP to 18%, and every single policy has saved money. And at some point, we have to be genuinely serious. These are not the right ways to build a 21st century healthcare system. These are 20th century ideas that have failed. And the idea that the only way to fix them is to endlessly do more is an unappealing one. The reality is healthcare is insanely expensive for the average American, insured or not insured.
Next question.
Yes, as a lead into my question, I want to raise the issue of doctor-owned hospitals and how they are treated under Obamacare, which is that there was a strict limit put on the expansion of doctor-owned hospitals unless they refused to accept Medicare or Medicaid. And doctor-owned hospitals have been controversial within the hospital industry, let's say, because of the supposed adverse selection problem. They tend to attract richer and healthier patients, but they're also more innovative and they have much higher satisfaction ratings than the traditional for-profit and so-called nonprofit hospitals. But I just want to use that as an example of how when there's additional regulatory burden put into the system, or when there's an expansion of government involvement in setting policy, that it inevitably responds to the there's regulatory capture. I mean, they essentially responded to the for-profit, nonprofit, very powerful lobbies to squelch the competition from doctor-owned hospitals. So why would that not simply be put on overdrive under going from, say, where we are today, 48% public spend is government or of healthcare spend is from government, going to say 70 like it is in Canada? Why would that not further squelch innovation and competition in the system than compared to what we have today?
Paul, you want to take the question?
I'm afraid I really don't know anything about doctor-owned hospitals. I think this was. This was a question of self-dealing and conflict of interest, and that's why limitations were put on it. But it's really not a subject I know a great deal about.
Well, I do know something about this subject because the questioner is exactly right. Doctor-owned hospitals have been killed almost everywhere, including at CMS, because they compete with general hospitals. And the argument was, oh, my God, look at the conflict of interest. But I think the general point is a more important one. I'm on the board of something called the Leapfrog Group, which presses for transparency in hospital safety. Our opponent is almost always CMS, which runs Medicare. CMS makes the argument that too much transparency is unfair to hospitals. Now, you can imagine if the FAA said, announcing which planes crash are unfair to airlines. The degree of industry capture in the way healthcare policy actually happens in this country is beyond anyone's imagination. And weirdly enough, it so distorts the way healthcare is delivered that this bizarre, superficial external conversation we have about how to pay for it ignores how the way we're paying for it is creating this reality. I could spend the rest of the night talking about ways in which CMS and the government have prevented competition. I mean, look at accountable care organizations. They're legal monopolies to save money. These people actually believe that if you give someone monopoly status, they will be more efficient and somehow pass those savings on, and 51 years of being wrong won't convince them it's just about to work. My fundamental problem is this. I believe in strong government regulation of the healthcare system. It's dangerous, it's unsafe, there are constantly new technologies, and it does an enormous amount of good. You got a choice. The government can be the industry's partner or regulator. It's not going to be both.
Next question.
Hey, so thanks a lot for making arguments concerning the efficacy of Medicare. But I have a more fundamental question. What is so special about healthcare that we can justify a government program to actually use tax dollars in order to subsidize this? Because I understand healthcare, there are benefits to having healthcare, but there are benefits to other things. Like, my girlfriend loves Chanel bags, and the fact that, you know, she's getting taxed for like Medicare means that she has less money to spend on Chanel bags. Why don't we like get a public option for like, you know, expensive handbags, right? I mean, and if you ask her, she might even say, like, you know, she cares about the Chanel bag right now because she's pretty healthy. So,
let David, you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, you actually can get Chanel bags under some Medicare Advantage programs, but, but I think, you know, look, the reality is we have a political system to determine social priorities. A lot of us do believe that there are things about healthcare that is unique, including as a service, that it's not going to work fully with a market like others. I believe that. I don't think that's true of all of healthcare, but I think it's true of a lot of healthcare. We don't want, and we are a wealthy enough country, that everybody in this country should be able to afford high-quality healthcare, and there are ways society can help do that. The bigger part of your question, though, is really crucial, which is the fundamental reason we and many other countries on Earth have decided that healthcare is the single most important thing the government should spend money on is probably an old one and probably a political one. And let's face it, if you're a politician, it is a lot easier to be arguing about access to healthcare and look at what I am giving you than to address the 9 more important things that contribute to your health. Social structure, marital structure, community safety, education, lifestyles. Those are difficult. Now, it's harder for us to address those without the money. So when I see Singapore paying 4% and think they've got 96% to spend on anything else, I like that.
Do you want to respond, Paul? Or do you want to?
Yeah. Well, we are a democracy. People have voted, and I think they've voted in reflection of the fact that if the private market were just left to itself, there would be millions of people who would be unable to afford care. That was indeed the situation facing many millions of seniors before Medicare was established. That's why there was the demand for it. The private insurance market was not interested in insuring older people who were bad risks. And so, so Americans responded to that reality. And the popularity of Medicare reflects the fact that Americans are getting some protection that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Next question.
Thanks both for a great debate. I wanted to get a little more elaboration on the idea of a catastrophic care system. I've read Meghan McArdle's proposal on an insurer of last resort system, which essentially would make healthcare or government-sponsored healthcare almost a FEMA-like system for healthcare, where individuals pay maybe 15 to 20% of their adjusted gross income. If they have healthcare expenditures that go over that amount, the government pays 100% of whatever those fees may be. And that if you're on the poverty line or something, it would be special exemptions, and it would be up to the individual then to decide within a private marketplace, I'm going to insure myself to take care of that potential 15 to 20% accident or emergency that I have that would cause me to go to the hospital and have a major procedure done. Would love both of your thoughts on if that system could work well, what the pros and cons would be, and so forth.
So can I respond to this? Because I really think there's something a lot of people may not get about this. 10% of the population in any given year accounts for about 2/3 of all of healthcare costs. There's another 50% of the population that only generate 3% of healthcare costs. Why is that? Because very sick people generate most of the costs. And in any given year, you know, a lot of people are healthy and they don't have any costs at all. So I maybe I didn't understand this proposal correctly, but if it's that everybody would pay 15% and then the government would pick up all the cost over, gee, that doesn't sound like a good deal to me. One of the difficulties that we have in controlling healthcare costs is that the usual deterrence that people are paying out of pocket doesn't work when people have these very high costs that are over their deductibles, even if they're in a high deductible plan. And so there's very little sensitivity to cost from the consumer's side, and there's no sensitivity from the provider's side. And that's effectively why you need some kind of regulation. It's because of this concentration of health costs, concentration of total expenditures, and because of the lack of the normal mechanisms that work in the market to control costs.
So, when I said that a remarkable amount of our healthcare system was based on incredibly old ideas, I was referring directly to what Professor Starr just said. So he's absolutely right. 10% of our population uses 65% of healthcare costs in any given year. So if you plan on living 1 year, that really matters. But by the way, that is less concentration than in any other expense of good and service. In any given year, less than 10% of the population buys 100% of the cars, 100% of the refrigerators, has 100% of the marriages, divorces, you name it. This idea, people have been saying in healthcare for 70 years without thinking of what in any given year means. In any given year, 10% of the population uses all of the college education. So what? We live 80 years. This is a question of finance. That has been the argument for having this massively complex, insanely expensive, ridiculously distortive system of insurance pay for everything. That argument. And it has no reference to anything else in human life. It's the island of healthcare. You go to a healthcare conference, you say what Professor Starr just said, everybody nods. But nobody says, what isn't that true of?
Well, it's true about the unpredictability.
But let me finish the point. We know that you're going to use a lot of healthcare certain times of your life, towards the end, at the beginning. We know that your healthcare demand is going to vary enormously over the years in between. We have tons of things like that. Healthcare is unique in that being the argument for creating this thing that adds $400 or $500 billion of administrative costs a year to you. That argument. And it makes no sense if you've ever been in any industry other than healthcare.
Did you want to respond, Paul, to that?
Yeah, because that's not really the point that I was making. The point is that when you have that concentration of expenditures, the normal mechanisms that people have counted on and that they're counting on even with high deductible plans, with your catastrophic coverage, that they don't work. They don't work in controlling the costs.
That's a complete misunderstanding. And I must admit, I hear this all the time from traditional healthcare experts. You know, every argument you have in healthcare is if it doesn't work for everybody all the time, it can't work, right? No, nothing else in our economy works like that, right? Some things work for some people, sometimes other people. We like diversity of services, diversity in the way you charge, alternatives for how something is delivered. Healthcare, every argument is, oh my God, a consumer-driven system can't work because if somebody's hit by a bus, they're too unconscious to shop for a hospital. I get it. But that is not the argument being made. The argument being made is we are now spending $1 million per person per life on healthcare. We can take a reasonable amount of that $1 million, since most of it will be spent on chronic conditions, and we can finance it in any number of ways that makes that person a consumer, so like we do with everything else.
David, let's be specific. Your favor of catastrophic coverage, is that right?
Genuinely.
So that's high deductible coverage?
Yes.
Yeah. So what happens when people hit the deductible? When they've gone over the deductible, how do you control the costs?
How do you control the costs?
That's right. They're now fully covered, okay? It's over the deductible. They're not. It's not coming out of their pocket.
Do you know how Singapore does it?
Well, it's that's
a. Do you know?
I'm sorry. That's
so Singapore does it.
But that's a government-controlled system,
right? But here's how Singapore does it. So Singapore, as you know, has at every single level of health spending, the individual is the actual customer. You know, in our system, the insurer and CMS is the customer. You're not actually the guy who buys the service, they do. So you're always the customer. And there is literally nothing for which you don't have to write some check, even tiny, which makes you sensitive to the total amount. But if your concern is that a system of catastrophic-only insurance, in the case of catastrophes, is going to lead to massive inflation, then let me suggest this. Since massive catastrophes are somewhere in the, depending on how you measure it, 15 to 20% of healthcare, let me run my system for the other 80%. You do whatever you want with the other 20%, and we'll take advantage of the fact. I don't know if you've ever had a tire blowout on a highway, but if you have a tire blowout on a highway, when the tow truck comes, he doesn't ask to look at your net worth statement. He charges you more than if you just shop for a replacement tire, but it's governed by the fact that there's a normal tire market. You're screwed when that happens, but he ain't taking your net worth. We have a healthcare system where the argument that, oh my, you know, Medicare's most expensive patient cost $2.5 million, it reported 5 years ago. That sound like a lot of money? It does, right? Except for the fact when you think about, we spend $1 million on average on every person over a lifetime now. It's only 2.5 times. Are we really gonna let that one person, that one extreme thing, not finance the $1 million sensibly? This isn't 1965 anymore. We're not talking about getting a few $100 from each of the people in the room and saying, don't worry, we'll take care of the rest. We're taking $1 million from each of the people in this room.
I'm not following you. In your high deductible catastrophic coverage, what controls the cost in cases that go over the deductible?
The insurer, just like you do now. What do you think controls it now? All insurance, so, an insurer pays a price to a payer.
So the insurer can say no.
The insurer can
are you giving the patient doctor any control at all at that point?
I don't understand your questions. I don't assume patient doctor. The insurer is not going to perform.
How are you proposing to control costs in the high cost cases that generate a very large proportion of our costs?
So what I'm willing to say is, it does not generate. That's no longer true. So that is no. By the way, your 10% in 65 was 10% in 80 as recently as 10 years ago. So that's changing meaningfully. But, well, yes, no, you're right. It comes down. Concentration comes down every year. That's my point, and yours too. So here's what I'm willing to say, is in those worst cases, keep the current system if you must, but build a market for the rest that's not, so that you actually, look what we have now. You go see a physician, and it's insured, and it's several $100s, and the insurer's gonna get several tens, the physician's gonna get several tens of dollars. It's an absurd system, adding cost to every transaction.
You know, something, you're knocking on an open door. Millions of people have high deductible coverage today. If that's what you want,
45 million.
You know, it already exists.
No, but it actually
and by the way, if you look at what people think about it, they hate it.
Well, but be honest. You go to a system where you say to somebody, you have a $500 deductible today, and then next year you say you have $1,500. So if the response was enthusiasm, I'd be stunned. The purpose of high deductible plans and genuine catastrophic insurance, which as you know is different from high deductible insurance. We have high deductible, I talk about catastrophic, is to say to people, the average family insured policy in America now costs $20,000 a year. $20,000. Now, you may not see it. The government has figured out lots of ways to take it from this pocket and that pocket and over here. Oh, you didn't see that. It's $20,000 a year if you have a family. $20,000. Now, unless you're wealthy, you're a janitor, it's $20,000. So unless you're wealthy, that's a lot of money. So the way catastrophic coverage works, which is not what we had under the Affordable Care Act, as you know, was explicitly prohibited, is to say, tell you what, take a $20,000 deductible, and insurance is going to cost you $7,000. Put $13,000 away a year. You're a year and a half away from paying for that deductible. That's how catastrophic insurance works. It's not just, hey, we increase your deductible and you're paying what you are now. It's we're increasing your deductible enough that we're freeing up the absurd amount of money we put into the expense and complexity of an insurance system. Now, here's what we've done in this country. Every year it gets more expensive, and every year intervention is ever more necessary so you can afford it. And here's the latest idea. A public option is going to make it cheaper for you. just like Medicare made it cheaper for seniors. But the only way Medicare made it cheaper for seniors is they're not still here to compare. You compare it to no Medicare, not to life before Medicare.
Next question.
Yeah, I guess it's mostly for Professor Starr. The Veterans Administration provides free or heavily subsidized medical care for qualified veterans, so it's basically Medicare for the small subset of people.
No, that's different. That's actual socialized medicine. The Veterans Administration is like the National Health Service.
It's different
from Medicare.
According to its own records, it provides fabulous service. Most of the people who need operations get them within 15 days. But then it turned out a couple of years ago, we discovered that, in fact, that was all a big fraud. They were taking months or even years. They just were fudging the books. But the veterans who were getting the benefits had no control because they weren't paying for them. The taxpayers who were paying for it didn't care because they didn't even know the beneficiaries who weren't getting the services. So why will your universal Medicare be more efficient, less fraudulent than VA was?
Or that still, has to be the last still, question still of the is. Evening. Thank you for the question. Paul, you might respond.
Yeah, well, that you're talking about a different idea. You're talking about a system in which the federal government actually owns the hospitals. It employs the doctors. As I said at the beginning, and really I think you ought to know this, I mean, Medicare is totally different. It's an insurance system. Medicare does not own the hospitals. It does not employ the doctors. In fact, it has a system where there's both a public plan and there are private alternatives. It's very different from the veteran system. Actually, the very first thing I ever wrote about healthcare was a critique of the veterans' healthcare system. I don't need to go back through that. But really, I mean, it's two different things.
We unfortunately have to close the Q&A part of the evening. Thank you for your questions. We're going to the summary portion of the evening, and you want to think about how you vote on the resolution. Paul, you have 5 minutes to sum up. You can go up to the podium and do that, and that'll be followed by David's summation. 5 minutes. Take it away, Paul.
Okay. Well, I have tried to make the case for making available to Americans a Medicare-like plan as an alternative that they can buy. I'm specifically talking about people who buy health insurance on their own. These are the people in the individual and, to some extent, the small group market. Those markets have functioned very inefficiently. And although the Affordable Care Act has enabled millions of people in that position to be able to afford insurance, the options available to them in many parts of the country have, in fact, been very limited. Those especially are true in rural areas, in the South, in the West. These are regions where there's very little competition. And there's an additional problem of competition that I mentioned. In many big cities, in many urban areas, where some hospital systems have achieved overwhelming power, where there's been a growth of monopoly power. And that has affected prices in those metropolitan areas. It's driven up insurance costs. And what we need in the rural areas and the South, in these areas where there is often only one insurer or maybe no insurers, we need Medicare to come in. I suggested that we should have both public Medicare and the private Medicare Advantage plans offered in those areas to stimulate competition. And I'd like to see a Medicare plan-like plan in many of the urban areas where there is monopoly power to be able to have some kind of a countervailing power from a public plan. So these are ideas not for a radical overturning of the healthcare system. It's not a single-payer plan that I'm talking about. It's using Medicare as a way to provide more options, more choices for people, and to countervail some of the power that's accumulated in the private marketplace. I mean, this is the reality, a reality which I really think David ought to address, the reality of monopoly power that has developed in healthcare, in provider markets, also in insurer markets, and that has distorted what we can expect the market left to itself to be able to do.
Thank you, Paul. 5 minutes for you, David, to do your summation.
Well, let me start with what Paul said, because he and I are in complete agreement of the dangers of monopoly power among healthcare providers. What he doesn't recognize is that that monopoly power has been encouraged by the major buyer of healthcare, the U.S. government. There's a narrative in healthcare that we're used to, which is after the war, developed countries recognized healthcare as an essential right to all citizens. And except in the United States, began addressing that need through a variety of different forms. There's actually quite a mix of healthcare systems in the developed world, but what they have in common is they have an enormous amount of government intervention in the markets. In America, this narrative goes like this. Only the United States, because of special interest and because of our unique politics, hasn't made this commitment. But it's coming. It's progress. It's the future. What if that narrative is backwards? What if the fact that these ideas were created when healthcare was fundamentally a one-size-fits-all industry no longer makes sense? What if the reason that every developed country on earth has difficulty paying for ever-growing healthcare, and despite what's often monopoly buying power, can't control prices, reflects the obvious mismatch between how healthcare is paid for and how we need it? What if this idea that everything in healthcare is like a building burning down, an insurance claim, is absurd on its face and sentences us to a system that very well serves bureaucrats, CMS, large insurance companies, and very poorly serves the customer? There's 315 million stories of why our healthcare system doesn't work. Some of them are about cost and access. A lot of them is about absolutely primitive use of electronic health records, despite the fact that Medicare gave $45 billion to create electronic health records. Some of it's about the absolute confusion of going from specialist to specialist or hospital to another service. Some of it is about poor care, accident, error, injury, death. Medicare itself says one out of every seven Medicare beneficiaries who goes into an hospital has an adverse health effect because of an error. What if we have an undisciplined, wasteful, expensive, complex, untransparent healthcare system, not because we don't have access, but because, in fact, the forces intended to discipline it don't? What if the narrative is completely backwards? What if the future of healthcare is much more like other things, actually using information technology to make it work better for the individuals? As we've moved from you have breast cancer to you have you cancer, is this healthcare system going to be able to adapt? Is this healthcare system going to work in an era of cures? While we've been going on this historic narrative to be like Europe, to have real coverage, we've missed the numbers. We've missed the fact that the average American young person now will be saddled with over $1 million of healthcare costs, in great part because we've built this massive system to protect her from healthcare costs. We've missed the fact that the average senior now pays more out of pocket now than the average senior did in 1965. We've missed the fact that the $1.5 trillion the United States governments, including the states, are going to spend on healthcare this year could instead be a $20,000 grant to half of American households every year. With a $60,000 median income and all of the issues we have, the island of healthcare prevents us from even thinking about that, even thinking about the transformation we could have. Look, there are many people on one side of this debate who are in love with the National Health Service. Apparently, they haven't followed very clearly what it's been dealing with in the last couple of years, a 70-year-old model. You know a lot of other great ways of running technologically complex, ever-changing dynamic industries that are 70 years old? I don't. Everything else got disrupted in the last 25 years. The first rule of getting out of a hole is to stop digging. Tonight's proposition is another shovelful. Thank you very much.
Okay, now, Please look back at your cell phones. The U.S. government should offer a Medicare-like plan that would be available to all Americans buying health insurance. Kate DeCherbo, would you come up to the stage again? Because we're going to have the final voting. Kate, are you there? There you are. Okay. Yeah. She's blind. Yeah. Oops, she's walking. Okay. All right. Okay. While you're considering the vote, Kate is doing the tally. And also, I want again to invite both Paul Starr and David to stick around for the party to discuss these issues further. Please buy a drink at the bar or to have some water and discuss these issues. And then as well, Larry will be our candidate for governor, will be at his table ready to discuss those issues with you as well. And so please stick around for the party. Kate?
How many minutes are we giving people?
Well, give me your judgment. We'll certainly give another minute for people to deliberate on the voting. And we'll see who wins the Tootsie Roll. What do you recommend, Kate? All right. Okay. The yes vote was 21% in favor before the voting began. The yes vote went down to 14% after the voting. So the yes vote lost 7 points. The no vote was at 47%, and it went up to 77%. So David Goldhill wins the Tootsie Roll. The noes have it. Thank you to Paul Starr. Thank you to David Goldhill. Please stick around for the party.